What I try to tell you, this country, you gotta make the money first. Then when you get the money, you get the power. Then when you get the power, then you get the woman. That's why you gotta make your own moves.
That's Al Pacino as Tony Montana in the 1983 crime drama Scarface. The movie has a lasting legacy that is still finding new audiences today. Film critic Glenn Kenny explores why in his book, The World Is Yours, The Story of Scarface. Glenn takes us behind the scenes of the iconic gangster film directed by Brian De Palma and written by Oliver Stone. His book contains everything about Scarface that we are too afraid to ask because we don't want to upset Tony enough to say,
"Say hello to my little friend!"
But we will clatter off with Glenn. He joins us now to talk about the making of a film that's nearly as entertaining as the movie itself. And he shares why Howard Hawks' 1932 prohibition flick Scarface got a remake in the 80s.
Well, there was nothing inherent in Howard Hawks' film that called for a remake. The whole reason that Scarface, the 1983 movie, exists is because of the will of Al Pacino and the will of his friend, one-time manager, and producer Marty Bregman. What had happened was that Al Pacino had been spending some time in Los Angeles and with a group of friends had seen a marquee for a repertory house advertising a screening of the 32 Scarface. You know, Pacino was a great scholar of acting and of actors. They went in and saw the film, and the thing that impressed Pacino the most was the incredible outsized performance of a guy named Paul Muni, who many of us today may not have ever heard of, but he was a very prominent actor in the 30s and 40s Hollywood.
You got something I like.
Yeah, I'm nice with a lot of dressing. You work fast, don't you, Tony?
Nah, say, I've been waiting a long time. I'm crazy for you. Everybody say Tony Camardi is a big shot. He's got everything he wants. Yeah, I got everything but what I want. You understand?
Pardon me.
Paul Muni, who came from Yiddish theater, playing this feral Italian-American gangster patterned after Al Capone named Tony Camonte, and Al Pacino was blown away by this performance. And like almost immediately after leaving the theater, it occurred to him to call Marty Bregman, with whom he had not spoken in some time. They had had a sort of falling out after they failed to get a film of the book Born on the 4th of July off the ground. That eventually became a film directed by the Scarface screenwriter, Oliver Stone, starring Tom Cruise, but that's another story. He called Marty Bregman because he thought, you know, well, Marty's a guy who can get this kind of thing done. He says, I think I have something I want to do with you. And the thing was Scarface, and it started from there. It was a couple of years, you know, at least a year of development before it went before cameras.
Mm-hmm. And you say that Scarface would not exist if it wasn't for Martin Bregman. And according to your book, he seems like this sheer force of a film producer. Can you talk about Marty and his role in creating the film?
He was a very unusual guy, Martin Bregman was. He was a New York-based businessman who got into artist management in the 60s. Started out with Faye Dunaway and a few people like that. It was Faye Dunaway who told him to check out Al Pacino on stage. But he worked out in New York, and he, sort of anticipating the super agents of CAA like Mike Ovitz, who would put together packages of different talents. So, you know, one of his early things for Al Pacino was to put together a film called The Panic in Needle Park. Eventually, Marty decided he didn't want to be a personal manager of performers anymore. He felt they were too needy overall, and it was increasingly egregious of him to hold their hands. But by the time he was approached by Al Pacino to do Scarface, they had had a couple of major films under their belts before falling out, including Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. Part of the job of producing Scarface was not only to mollify the studio heads, who ended up spending way more money than they had thought they were going to spend. But also, he too was back in the position of holding Al Pacino's hand, because Al had a lot of ideas about what to do with his character, and he wanted to basically do all the ideas while shooting, which meant doing take after take after take after take. One of the editors of the film, David Ray, told me, you know, getting the final version of Pacino's performance onto a fixed film was incredibly difficult because the way he would approach his character in every scene doing multiple takes was always different. There was never any, very rarely consistent through line in take after take. So the issue was finding the takes that most coherently corresponded with each other as the linear path of the narrative goes forward.
Right. Oliver Stone wrote the screenplay for Scarface, and he did all of his research while he was on cocaine. It's as if he was channeling his inner Marlon Brando to be a method screenwriter. How did that go over?
Well, you know, he did the research while doing the drug. He didn't do the writing while doing the drug. He worked on it with Sidney Lumet, initially trying to do a version of it that would be essentially a straight remake, that would be a period piece taking place in the 1930s with Pacino playing Tony Camonte, this Italian-American character who's based on Al Capone. And Sidney Lumet was attached to it at the time, and Lumet said, this makes no sense, this has no relevance. What would be interesting is to do it now, and to do it instead of bootlegging liquor, do the cocaine trade. Oliver Stone, who, you know, at the time was abusing cocaine, was like, ah, interesting idea. And Marty Bregman liked that idea too. He liked that idea to a certain extent. He didn't like the idea when Sidney Lumet wanted to add a political dimension to it. And mm-hmm. that's how Sidney Lumet got removed from the movie. But yeah. Stone did have a strategy. He was not feeling well. He was abusing cocaine, but it was useful when he was going to Miami and then going to Bimini and really hanging out with the gangsters who were, you know, involved in the trafficking of the drug, you know, seeing off the cigarette boats from Bimini to Miami. If you're hanging out with those guys and trying to find out the real deal and, you know, you want to gain their confidence, it's helpful not to turn them down when they offer you the product that they themselves are partaking in. Mm-hmm. So while I certainly don't, I don't think Oliver Stone himself nor anybody else would condone this practice. You know, at the time, as a contingency, it rather came in handy. So, yeah, he did not do coke while writing. And yeah. as a matter of fact, nothing, there's no, some people have looked at the movie's energy and excess and said, well, they had to have been doing drugs while shooting this. And I was like, no, they you know, if they had been doing drugs while shooting this, there'd be actual dead people as a result of the movie. As it happened, neither Brian De Palma nor Al Pacino had ever come near cocaine in their lives, nor did working on this film induce them to experiment with it.
Yeah. You were able to interview Brian De Palma. What was the most fascinating thing you learned about the production of Scarface from Brian?
The most interesting thing, I think, was Brian's own attitude, which was very workmanlike. He insisted that once he came on board the project, all he wanted to do was do justice to Oliver Stone's script. And when you talk to Oliver Stone and some of the other people involved in the production, you hear a lot about Oliver Stone's dissatisfaction with how De Palma, you know, handled the script and the things he cut from it. So it was interesting to get inside of his head, working as not entirely a personal filmmaker, but as a professional filmmaker for hire, which is a position he found was something important to exercise in his career at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oliver Stone had input into the casting process, and he clashed with producer Marty Bregman over the creation of the Elvira character. Who did Stone want to play Elvira?
Stone was very keen to have Glenn Close play the character. And I don't want to get into too much ad hominem in terms of the the terms that were passed around, but Bregman didn't see Close as the character. Bregman wanted someone who was more in line with his own idea of a beautiful ice princess. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Michelle Pfeiffer, who ended up getting the part, did bear a slight resemblance at the time to Cornelia Sharp, who was Bregman's sort of muse during the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there was some angst about casting Michelle Pfeiffer because she was a bit too warm as a person. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, she has a natural warmth as an actor, and it's something that they weren't concerned about so much in the casting, but they were very concerned about in the shooting.
Hello.
I need Roberta. Vera.
So, there are five of us. Where are we having dinner?
I thought we'd go to the Babylon Club.
Again.
Again.
You know, Frank, if anyone ever wanted to assassinate you, you wouldn't be too hard to find.
Michelle Pfeiffer was very insecure and, on the set. She was very young. She felt untested, and she felt like she was failing all the time. But she was treated well by everybody involved. In fact, Martin Bregman became a kind of father figure to her subsequent to that. And De Palma was also very kind, but he did have one thing that he said to her after every take was done, which is, "Did you smile?" And she would say, "No, I didn't smile." He's like, "Good." There's one exception to that that made it into the movie that I won't give away here, but the whole thing about Elvira was don't smile.
What did you think of Pfeiffer's performance?
I think it's great. It was a useful performance for her because even though it doesn't show off her natural warmth as an actor, it shows her off as a serious actor, and that's something she wasn't able to do up until this point with what with the sitcom Delta House and Grease 2 and things like that, very bubbly stuff that did not, you know, really call upon her gifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally forgot until I read it in your book. I totally forgot about her being in that Animal House spinoff, Delta House. Al Pacino plays Tony Montana as a Cuban. How did the Cuban community feel about this?
At the time, it wasn't terribly controversial. There were some, the Cuban community, certain aspects of the Cuban community, both in Miami, both criminal and non-criminal, weren't too crazy about the whole idea of portraying the drug trade as being overseen by Cuban Americans.
You know, all we hear about in the papers is animals like you and the killings. It's Cubans like you who are giving a bad name to our people. People who come here and work hard and make a good name for themselves. People who send their children to school and pay their taxes.
What are you saying? That's your son!
Son! I wish I had one. He's a bum. He was a bum then, and he's a bum now.
And that's why the production got chased out of Miami very early on and had to kind of sneak back in after most of the principal photography was finished a few months later. The type of pushback you get now relative to ethnic representation and authenticity in movies wasn't nearly as vehement as it is today. So that kind of pushback wasn't too pronounced. And in fact, Tony Montana says at the very beginning that his father was an American and that he's half Yankee anyway. So there is that.
Yeah, good point. Well said. I learned from your book that it is rumored that if Al Pacino could drop one film from his legacy, he would remove Scarface. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's the opinion of, I think, where I got that from was Michael Bregman, who's Martin Bregman's son. I'm not sure that's entirely true. Pacino, you know, will do public events where he'll do Q&As and he'll bask in the applause that is accorded certain films, those films being Godfather Parts 1 and 2, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, and Scarface. Scarface gets much more applause than the film that won him his Oscar, Scent of a Woman. But Michael Bregman feels that, Al feels that Scarface isn't dignified enough. You know, he'd rather talk about Richard III. Of course, you know, gangster movies are Richard III in fancy suits anyway, some people might tell you. But, you know, when Pacino's in front of a crowd and mentions Scarface and everybody goes, "Hey," then he loves to talk about Scarface then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. You quote our friend of the show and frequent beta guest, Shea Serrano, at length near the end of your book about the impression Scarface still has on pop culture. In your opinion, what is it about Scarface that keeps enduring?
Well, it's a little different than the appeal of Goodfellas, which was the subject of my last book, where you had this kind of thrill of the constant transgression that was privilege that was enjoyed by, you know, criminal foot soldiers of the mafia. Here, the aspiration or the intrigue comes from becoming a kingpin, making it to the top. As the song in the movie itself says, pushing it to the limit. You know, what's that like? How do you do it? And, you know, the nerve of Tony Montana. Because, you know, early on, certain situations he goes into that's a binary situation. You know, you either win or you die.
Let's get this straight now. All I have in this world is my balls and my word. And I don't break them for no one. Do you understand? I hear he's not. Do you want to go on with me? To say it. You don't. Then you make a move.
And Tony will go into those situations seemingly not caring about the dying part. So he's either going to win or he's not going to be around anymore. But if he's not around anymore, it never mattered anyway, because what's the point? And that kind of almost nihilistic dedication to making it to the top is the fascination of the Tony Montana character, combined, of course, with the nerve that it takes to get into those situations and, you know, do what you're going to do once you come out on top.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Why do you think Scarface has had such a strong influence on hip-hop artists?
Well, you know, my friend Harry Allen and I hash it out, and, you know, he said something very interesting about the whole idea of getting to the top of something, the aspiration.
Look, Frank, time is gone. We got to expand. Whole operation, distribution, New York, Chicago, L.A. We got to set our own mark and enforce it. We got to think big now.
You know, Harry said Tony Montana, like, you know, the hip-hop artists who admire him, comes from an impoverished upbringing. Most rappers of the, you know, he comes on the Mariel boatlift. Most rappers are the descendants of people who are boatlifted with hostility. Not recently, but hundreds of years ago, but nevertheless, Tony has an unrepressed ambition. And that's the key to it, unrepressed ambition. So, you know, coming from nothing with an unrepressed ambition, that's a huge thing in hip hop. And Tony Montana certainly embodies that.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Glenn Kenny, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The World Is Yours, The Story of Scarface. It's the definitive book about the film, and it is amazing that we're still talking about it 41 years after its release.
I appreciate being given the chance to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Glenn Kenny is the author of The World Is Yours, The Story of Scarface. Find out more about Glenn and Scarface at WPR.org/beta.
I said it's a serious show because in the show I'm solving problems.
What's the difference between being a clown, a comedian, and a tragedian? We'll find out when we talk to Julia Masley, coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.